Thank you much, Sasha, for this introduction. Issues of migration, hospitality, publicity, and translatability, and at times untranslatability, ever concurred in progressively reorienting our understanding of narrative practices, encouraging us to think beyond the nation. As Raymond Williams observes, in fact, immigration first certain productive kinds of strangeness and distance, a new consciousness of conventions and thus of changeable because now open conventions. So consequently, contact zone and cross-cultural dynamics are crucial in the debate of a cosmopolitanism for the leaders to interpret cosmopolitanism not as a cultural hierarchy, but as an ongoing negotiation between proximity and distance. In this dynamic scene, the emigre periodical press has a significant part to play, not only because it encapsulates all the issues and anxieties that cosmopolitanism entails, but also because it makes them the object of public debate, triggering the negotiation of a distinctive cosmopolitan public sphere. So, Yakov Priluka's monthly journal entitled The Angry Russian, here's Yakov Priluka, his journal is paramount in this respect, particularly for the cross-cultural encounters it promoted. So while showing how the late Victorian year for periodical press also invested Russians in Britain, Priluka's journal sheds light on how Anglo-Russian literary collaborations took active part in breaking the borders of national provincialization. What I will argue in my paper is that Priluka's career was directly influenced by his collaboration with English figures, particularly with Annabel Gray and the Wright sisters, in the hope of showing how this form of intellectual dialogue and cross-cultural exchange pose a challenge to both hegemonic discourses of national identity and traditional narrative, moving towards the negotiation of a cosmopolitan aesthetics. Right. So, founded in the summer 1897, the Anglo-Russian is a representative example of Russian emigre press in Britain. By addressing the English reading public in its own language, it is interesting because it was written by a Russian emigre, but it was written in English. So the Russian editor aimed at awakening the British public opinion to Russian affairs, at providing a trustworthy alternative to Tsarist counter-revolutionary propaganda, and unearthing Victorian Russophobia, which was basically based on ignorance and negative stereotypes. So as Priluka declares in the editorial note of the July issue 1897, the chief aim of the Anglo-Russian is to endeavour to remove those misunderstandings which at present divide two such great nations as the English and the Russian in antagonistic camps, suspicious of one another to the detriment of their mutual interests and the interests of the world at large. So collaborations with British sympathisers proved crucial for Priluka. In 1895, he met Elizabeth and Emily Ride, advanced pacifists of suffragist idea, who offered him linguistic advice. They basically proofread his English papers, as well as moral and financial support. In fact, they encouraged him to publish The Anglo-Russian. Priluka's connection with the popular Victorian novelist Annabel Gray was equally significant, for it culminated in the publication of From the Stage to the Cross, a short story which was serialized in The Anglo-Russian from January 1898 to December 1900. So however temporary, these collaborations call attention to issues of language, hospitality, community building that all marked Anglo-Russian cross-cultural exchanges at the turn of the 20th century. So this blurring of geographical and cultural borders converged in Priluka's experience and led him to negotiate the cosmopolitan aesthetics of his newspaper, which, as the title suggests, is to be interpreted in terms of hybridity and in-betweenness. So the success of the paper did not only depend on its circulation. For example, the first issue, the print run of the first issue of The Anglo-Russian exceeded 2,600 copies, but it was also based on the influence it had on the British periodical press. As the editor observes in his editorial note, many English newspapers freely quote from the Anglo-Russian without acknowledging the original source. Well, this attitude was destined to change at the turn of the 20th century, where always more English newspapers started mentioning the Anglo-Russian and its editors' enterprises in their columns. For example, the Durham Chronicle, the Times, the Daily Telegraph, Daily News, Daily Mail, Eastbourne Standard, etc. So as it turned out, Priluka was eager to create a public institution in the Anglo-Russian, an authentic organ of opinion that could reorient the British dominant opinion on the Russian present condition, as well as on the indisputable value of Russian literature and culture. So the Anglo-Russian engaged in an ongoing dialogue with leading English newspapers. Cross-references and fluxes of information did not only increase the importance of all things Russian in mainstream discussions, but it also documented the existence of overlapping audiences, of inter-public discursive interactions. So as Tuzan observes, niche papers, as the Anglo-Russian is actually, are eager to establish their own readership. That is to say, a community of readers that stands out as an alternative to mainstream publics. This is also true for the Anglo-Russian, for it engaged in the creation of its own alternative community of readers, which, as the title suggests, was to be an Anglo-Russian one. In fact, the Anglo-Russian published articles in both English and Russian, and for this reason it was addressed to both English speakers and Russian speakers. In Nancy Fraser's opinion, subaltern counterpublics within stratified societies, as late Victorian England was, have a dual character. So on the one hand, they function as spaces of withdrawal and regroupment, but on the other hand, they also function as base and training grounds for agitational activities directed towards a wider public. So this is precisely the case of the Anglo-Russian. So while wishing to establish his own niche within late Victorian England, and so it was radically localized, because it was aiming at creating a distinctive Anglo-Russian alternative community, the journal also attempted to cross the English national frontier. So as the editorial issue of the May issue of 1898 records, it is intending at the approaching anniversary of its publication to make the Anglo-Russian more international in its character by introducing articles not only in the Russian language but also in German, French and occasionally Italian. The interest and influence of the magazine will in this way be greatly extended, and it will, we anticipate, gradually become a centre around which we rally a large proportion of those men and women who cherish the noble aspiration of the amelioration of the human race. So that's very funny. Priluka's published his editorial article, in fact, this article in English, French and German. So the first page was divided into three columns and it was published in these three languages. By addressing potential European readerships in their own language, particularly in English, French and German, the editor looks for a public beyond the nation. The imposing presence of advertising notes in Yiddish and of articles in Russia sheds further light on the editor's intention to increase the international status of the journal. As a result, the community-building aspect of reading was not only confined within the English national borders, but Priluka wished to create a transnational community, thereby mapping a new discursive space. So as Hampton observes, think of periodicals as instruments for the ordering of geographical space, or as a form of territory mapping. The territories they survey and report and distribute copies to and take advertisements from can sometimes appear remarkably well-defined and yet startlingly strange, the boundaries conforming to no very obvious political or demographic boundaries. So challenging the discrete boundaries of national market, language and identity, the Anglo-Russian, while trying to establish its own niche in the British periodical market, simultaneously served as a new discursive space for the creation of a new dynamic international community of readers. Interestingly, Priluka's journal has always demonstrated a keen interest in literature and the arts, In fact, the Anglo-Russian published pieces of literature, especially poems and short stories, translated from the Russian, and occasionally from the Yiddish and the Finnish, were of course translated into English. So, by inscribing foreign voices in the English literary panorama, the Anglo-Russian expanded the horizons of material publishable in British journals and magazines. Translations, therefore, did not only contribute to the making of the polyphonic voice of the Anglo-Russian, but it also underlined its community-building nature, juxtaposing authors belonging to different literary traditions. In fact, Pre-Lucas seemed, in my opinion, to offer to his reader a new cosmopolitan community of, letters cutting across history. So cross-cultural fertilization and community building are also embedded in Pre-Lucas' literary attempt in the English language, namely From the Stage to the Cross. So as Pre-Lucas observes in a footnote in the third installment of the short story, the story was originally intended to be a short one and finish in three chapters. The editor, who cooperated with the author, Madame Annabel Gray, in writing the first two chapters, found it, however, desirable to extend the narrative as long as its interest could be kept up to the advantage of the chief aim in view, which was, of course, to promote the Russian cause for freedom in England. Madame Gray, to whom this contribution was entirely a labour of love, quite agreed with the editor's suggestion, but found that her other literary engagements would not allow her to devote more time to the work in the extended length. We thank Madame Gray most cordially for the kind assistance she gave in opening the story, for the contents of which we shall alone be responsible henceforth. So the polyphony of authorial voices in From the Stage to the Cross alimented the cross-cultural atmosphere of Pre-Lucas' journal, a form of in-betweenness that is textualized in the story itself, both at structural and narrative levels. So the story basically revolves around two English actresses, Rosalind Montgomery and Maud Carrington, and their encounter with Russian revolutionary emigres. While Rosalind decides to abandon her previous life in England and to move to Russia, her companion remains in Britain to provide support to the Russian cause from the UK. So as far as the structure of the novel is concerned, as far as the structure of the short story is concerned, it is divided into two sections. The first, from chapter 1 to 17, is set in London, while the second one, from chapter 18 to 35, and it was supposed to be a short story, is set in St. Petersburg and in the small town of Lipovky. So this structure, however, is far from suggesting an unbridgeable gap between the two countries and for their respective traditions. In fact, the epistolary exchange that occurs in the three last chapters of the story between the two main characters, one in London and the other in Russia, suggests an ongoing dialogue between the two countries, an exchange that metaphorically weaves together the two capitals. So not only at the structural level, but also the linguistic one evokes Anglo-Russian connections. Though written in the English language, the short story is also pervaded by sentences in Russian transliteration. They are, of course, immediately followed by the English translation in order to make the story intelligible to an English audience. For example, John McGregor's speech, John McGregor is another character in the story, is a telling example in this respect. And apologies for my Russian accent, Sasha. Я никогда не лгу в моей жизни, товарищи, а если вы не верите мне, то лучше не слушайте. Which translated into English means, I never told a lie in my life, comrades, and if you don't believe what I say, you had better not come to listen to me. So the coexistence of two linguistic codes in From the Stage to the Cross brings issues of multilingualism and translatability on the forefront, and stands out as a form of strategy to articulate the motif of hybridization, conceived here in terms of Anglo-Russianness. So Anglo-Russian connections are also exemplified at the narrative level, for the main character constantly travels from England to Russia and vice versa. So John McGregor, who is a revolutionist, is the revolutionist who inspired Rosalind to move to Russia, has frequently traveled himself from the two capital, between the two capitals since he was a boy. And any time he returned to Russia, he always had new stories to tell to his mates. John immediately started to give them, his friends, an eloquent lecture on English politics, the gist of which was that Englishmen and English boys or girls do what they like, can hold meetings, organize demonstrations, and the Queen has nothing to do with them. His taste of life in England infused new ideas, indeed, a new life into his Russian friends, awakening the critical thought of all they saw around them. So anecdote telling, however, is not the only means to facilitate cross-cultural exchanges. Ideas also circulated through literature. Its publication being prohibited in Russia, literature was printed abroad, especially in Geneva, in this case in Geneva, and then it was smuggled into Russia. So this ongoing flux of people, ideas, and literature sheds light on the permeable borders of the national frontiers, thereby facilitating exchanges beyond the nation and favoring reciprocal cross-cultural fertilization. Interestingly, John McGregor's biography is a telling example of Anglo-Russian miscegenation. So John McGregor was not quite exact in describing himself as a pure Scotchman. His grandfather hailed from the capital of the Scottish Islands. He went to Russia, married a Slav girl, and John's father married a Russian girl too. His children, however, were brought up in Scotland. John's character reunited the finest traits of the Anglo-Saxon and Slavonic races. The mixture of blood running in his veins had shaped him into a perfected type, the nationality of which was difficult to discover. He looked rather like a foreigner to Russians and to Englishmen alike. So John can be truly defined as a hybrid character, for his identity slips national categorization. In fact, he looks a foreigner to Englishmen and Russians alike. In his first encounter with Maud and Rosalind, sheds further light on how difficult it was to unveil his national identity. What is that Maud? Can it be indeed a sandwich man? And where country does he hail from? Oh, Rosalind, don't you see that he is, or apparently represents, a Russian? The astrakhan cap, top boots, and red shirts are only worn by Russian. So although John is more of an Anglo-Russian character in the light of his mixed genealogy, which we have just seen, when Rosalind asks him whether he is a real Russian, he promptly replies that he is a real Scotchman. So in the wake of Robin's argument, which sees, and I quote, cosmopolitanism as a reality of reattachment, multiple attachment, or attachment at a distance, end quote, John can be truly described as a cosmopolitan character, for he commands such attachments, as his Anglo-Russianness demonstrates. Hyphenated identities become, therefore, the hallmark of Yakov Priluka's cosmopolitanism. So this Anglo-Russian cosmopolitanism also characterizes everyday life at the International Liberty Brigade, which was at the headquarters of the Russian emigres in London. In fact, there you can see a company which was distinctly an international one, fair Germans or Swedes contrasting with brown-faced Italian and Spaniards, Armenians or Greek. To hear their various songs and to watch their individuals and their manners were decidedly interesting. So as a result, the printing office, this office was actually the printing office where Russian revolutionists and their sympathizers printed prohibited literature in Russia, in London, and then smuggled it into Russia. This office kind of promotes a new kind of urban encounter with unfamiliar forms, a phenomenon that stemmed out of mass migration. So this headquarter, therefore, appears as a cultural melting pot, not in the sense of a place that necessarily leads to assimilation and homogenization, but as a site of fertile cross-cultural dialogue, a space of cultural and intellectual mobility and mixture where national, cultural, and linguistic barriers seem to be blurred. So it becomes a cosmopolitan space inhabited by an alternative cosmopolitan community cooperating in the defense of Russian freedom in this case. So, as we have seen, cross-cultural exchanges and transnational mobility contributed to shaping her hybrid identities. But this process, a process of Bildung, culminates in the very last passage of the novel, where Rosalind's rambling thought struggle to find an order. And she writes a letter to her companion in London. "Dearest Maud, my thoughts are getting confused and I fear my mind is darkening. Am I myself a real personality? Is the chaplain sitting beside me? Is that woman a real personality too? Am I? Whom am I and what am I? What is the meaning of all that happened in my life, in your life, in the life of past generations and those in yet to come?" So Rosalind's letter clearly reflects the anxieties of modernity, particularly the problematic idea of reality and the complexity of self and identity. Interestingly, Rosalind's quest for identity was largely informed by her encounter with the other, and particularly with John McGregor, who encouraged her to become a secret informer for the Russian revolutionists. In other words, Rosalind's quest for identity takes place in the wake of Anglo-Russian political, personal and cultural exchanges, which lead her to explore whether and where her English past and her Russian present lives intersect, and to eventually find a balance between different experiences. So no longer perceived as a synonym for nationality, identity becomes a motif to be explored, a discursive space all marked by the encounter with the other in an ongoing negotiation between proximity and distance, a heterogeneous geography that is the crux and pivot of the cosmopolitan mood of modernity. So, moving towards the conclusion, as we have seen, practices of cosmopolitanism do not simply recur in canonical modernist literature within the postcolonial discourse or in contemporary theories. Cosmopolitanism, in fact, is also deeply rooted in late Victorian tradition and becomes of even greater importance when experiences of international migration are involved. In conclusion, by drawing connection among experiences separated in time, place, and tone, by bridging geographically and ethically disparate events, Priluka's short story re-articulates concerns of hybridity, in-betweenness, multilingualism, hospitality, and community building that proved crucial to his journalistic enterprise, negotiating the cosmopolitan aesthetics of the Anglo-Russian, an aesthetics which was largely informed by foreign voices and particularly by Russian voices. Thank you very much.